Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's more than just a few of us. We would do very well to take those bronze mirrors, so to speak, and bring them to the Lord and say, melt it down and make something glorious for your tabernacle. Oh Lord, it's not like I should never look at my life. Of course you should. Of course I should. We all should be. Of course we should look at our life from time to time. I'm not asking you to live a life free of self-awareness and looking at, but we all can know that this can go too far very easily. Become a life that's built upon self-focus instead of God-focus.
Moses called for all those who were willing to bring articles to use for the building of the tabernacle. Many brought fine clothing, jewelry, and gold mirrors to be melted down to use in the building of the tabernacle. In today's message, Pastor David sees in the surrendering of these gold mirrors by the Israelites a turning from self to God, which we all would do well to emulate. In surrendering those mirrors, they turned from focusing on themselves to focusing on Him. So who are you focusing on, yourself or God? Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
Well, we begin this morning in Exodus chapter 36. And as we begin, we note that we're sort of beginning a long section, almost to the end of the book of Exodus, where the tabernacle that was previously described in the book of Exodus is now actually going to be built. And it just sort of strikes me as I think, how interesting would it be for someone to just sort of come in off the street, and maybe they haven't been with us through all of our studies through the book of Exodus, which, by the way, I've enjoyed so much. And this morning, we bring it to an end. We're done with the book of Exodus after this morning. No, I don't mean you have to be done with it. You're free to read it anytime you want to in your Bible. It remains. But, you know, we're done with it in our Sunday morning teaching series through it. And the next book of the Bible that we get into is going to be the book of Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament. It's a fantastic book, and it has such a great link. It's a very logical place to go from Exodus to the letter to the Hebrews, because so many of the themes just transfer over from that. And so we'll be starting on that. But in any regard, just think about how strange it might be for somebody who hasn't been with us through our previous studies in the book of Exodus, saying, you're taking my time to talk about building a tent some 3,500 years ago. And the gold and this and that. Well, look, let me just read this section to you, how they're making the curtains. Let's look at it now. Exodus chapter 36, beginning at verse 8. Ready for this? Then all the gifted artisans among them who worked on the tabernacle made 10 curtains woven of fine linen and of blue, purple, and scarlet thread. With artistic designs of cherubim, they made them. The length of each curtain was 28 cubits, and the width of each curtain was 4 cubits. The curtains were all the same size. And he coupled 5 curtains to another, and the other 5 curtains he coupled one to another. He made loops of blue yarn on the edge of the curtain, on the selvedge of one set. Likewise, he did on the outer edge of the other curtain of the second set. 50 loops he made on one curtain, 50 loops he made on the edge of the curtain, and on the end of the second set. The loops held one curtain to another. And he made 50 clasps of gold, and coupled the curtains to one another with the clasps, that it might be one tabernacle. I don't blame a person for looking over that and saying, what is going on here? Curtains and clasps and designs of cherubim and gold and this and that. What's happening collectively with this? Well, again, let me put this in context of the whole book of Exodus. The book of Exodus tells a story of how the children of Israel came out of their slavery in Egypt, and God started leading them towards the promised land. As we end the book of Exodus today, they're not to the promised land yet. They're still camped at Mount Sinai. But while they were encamped at Mount Sinai, not only did God give them the law in the sense of the Ten Commandments and other law, but God also gave them instructions for building a tent of worship. That tent of worship would one day become a temple that was set in Jerusalem, but until it was a temple, it existed as a tabernacle that was built according to an exact pattern that God gave to Moses up on Mount Sinai. Well, they were commanded to build it previously in the book of Exodus. Now they're going to actually do the building in the chapters that we survey together this morning. So just as I read to you in Exodus chapter 36, verses 8 through 13, it describes how they made the curtains, the things that would actually cover over the tent, that would actually be the fabric that went over and made the tent a tent. If you don't have the fabric going over, you just have a frame. But now here's the curtains that will make the tent a tent. Then it goes on to describe in Exodus chapter 36 these other items that will fill the tabernacle. But let me just say this at the outset. Friends, you might think that this is just some sort of interesting, or I don't know, maybe not very interesting to you, a survey of what happened 3,500 years ago and how they made some building project. But I want you to know that that is just the bare outline of it. The extreme relevance of this to you and I today is simply this. Does God dwell among men? And when God was going to dwell among Israel 3,500 years ago, he said, build me a tabernacle to symbolize and to be the emblem of my dwelling amongst you. Well, we don't have a tabernacle today. Today we're meeting in a different kind of building. But I'll tell you this, God still wants to dwell among men. He still wants to fill the lives of men and women who have a vital concern after him. And that's what our text is concerned with, as you'll see towards the end of our time together this morning. But in any regard, Exodus chapter 36, verses 14 through 18, they talk about the curtain of goat's hair. Then they talk about the curtain of ram skin dyed red and badger skins. Then they talk about the boards connecting and for the frame and the walls of the tabernacle. Then they talk about the veil and the screen with their pillars. That makes up all of chapter 36. Then in chapter 37, it begins to describe the construction of the tabernacle furniture. Again, they were commanded to build it back. Previously, now they actually build it. So you have the Ark of the Covenant in Exodus chapter 37. You have the mercy seat with the golden lid to the Ark of the Covenant. That's in verses 6 through 9 of Exodus 37. Then you have the table of showbread and its utensils. That was the table that symbolized Israel's continuing fellowship with God. Then you had the golden lampstand. That went into the tabernacle as well. That was the light that filled the tabernacle tent. Then you had the altar of incense and its incense with the oil that was all made according to the instructions that God gave. That comprises Exodus chapter 37. Now, aren't we moving through this very quickly? Perhaps a little bit too quickly for you. Maybe you think, wait, more. Tell me more about this Ark of the Covenant. I remember the Ark of the Covenant. I saw a movie about the Ark of the Covenant. But for the main point, we just want to see here. God commanded them to build it, and what did they do? They built it. And that's what the story is telling us. And then on in Exodus chapter 38, they're not done doing the building work. Exodus chapter 38 says there's going to be an altar for sacrifice. So verses 1 through 7 describe this altar with the grate at the bottom where they would come and actually sacrifice the animals unto the Lord. Then it describes in verse 8 of Exodus 38 the bronze laver, this pool that they would use to get the water for the ceremonial washings for the priests in the conducting of their duties. Now I just got to pause just for a moment, because there's something very fascinating about the construction of this bronze laver that's stated in verse 8. Would you look at your Bible there? Look at Exodus chapter 38, verse 8. This is what it says. He made the laver of bronze and its base of bronze from the bronze mirrors of the serving women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now, isn't that an interesting place to get the raw materials for the building of this structure? You get the mirrors of the women who served at the tabernacle. Apparently, there were a group of women who just gave themselves in dedicated service. I don't know if you could exactly call it the women's ministry of ancient Israel, but it was something like that. Women that just said, you know, the priests do their work with slaughter and sacrifice, and that's not my place, but I want to serve the Lord. I want to make myself available to the work of the tabernacle. Well, these were women. And of course, being women, they had mirrors. That's a little joke, because some of you men are just as bad or worse as some of the ladies. Let's face that. But anyway, these ladies had mirrors. And what did they do? Well, when they came to build this laver, they said, we've got bronze mirrors. Because, you know, in the ancient world, they would make a mirror out of polished metal. And they took these mirrors and they said, you know what? We don't need to look so much at ourselves. Give it to the work of the Lord. You got to admit, that's a pretty dramatic thing for them to do in the Old Testament times. Because I don't think women cared less about their appearance in Old Testament times than they do in the modern day. And yet they were perfectly willing to say, no, not so much self-examination, more for the glory of the Lord. Now, isn't that an exciting and I would say powerful, transferable picture unto us? You see, look, let's face it. There's many of us who are obsessed with looking at ourselves. Now, I'm not talking about in terms of appearance. Although, look, that may be a problem for you, just frankly. I mean, maybe you are. Maybe you're overly concerned about your appearance. Some of us, we could do to be a little bit more concerned about our appearance, but that's another matter whatsoever. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something else entirely. I'm talking about that self-focus where your whole life is lived as if you're looking at a mirror and the only thing that's important is you. How does it feel to me? Is it fun for me? Is it entertaining for me? Does it make me look good? Does it make me more popular? Me, me, me. Ladies and gentlemen, there's more than just a few of us. We would do very well to take those bronze mirrors, so to speak, and bring them to the Lord and say, melt it down and make something glorious for your tabernacle. Oh, Lord, it's not like I should never look at my life. Of course you should. Of course I should. We all should be. Of course we should look at our life from time to time. I'm not asking you to live a life free of self-awareness and looking. But we all can know that this can go too far very easily. Become a life that's built upon self-focus instead of God-focus. That's a very powerful thing there in verse 8. And in any regard, that's what they did. And then after that, in Exodus chapter 38, it speaks of building the court with its pillars and its linen fence. And then Exodus 38 continues with an inventory of the materials that they used to build the tabernacle. So chapter 38, verses 21 through 23, it describes the leaders of the work. It's sort of an inventory of the human resources. And then the rest of the chapter describes the inventory of gold, the inventory of silver, the inventory of bronze, because they needed to know how much they had of all those things to properly manage the work, because these were the Lord's resources. It was the Lord's tent. They had to manage it well for his glory. Now we come to chapter 39. And don't you see how quickly we're summarizing these chapters here? Chapter 39 describes the making of the priestly garments. Way back previously in the book of Exodus, it said, make garments for the high priest and then for the regular serving priest. Make them for beauty and for glory. So first in the verse 7 verses of Exodus chapter 39, make an ephod that's sort of like an apron that would go from, you know, the upper area of the chest down below. Make an ephod for the high priest. And then make a breastplate that would go out on the outside. And then make a robe. And then make tunics and turbans and sashes and trousers for all the priests. Do that. And then after all of that was done, Exodus chapter 39 tells us that there was an overview of the work. Look at it here at verse 42 of Exodus chapter 39. It says, according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did all the work. Then Moses looked over all the work, and indeed they had done it. As the Lord had commanded, just so they had done it, and Moses blessed them. What beautiful obedience! Don't you see how beautiful that is? God told us to do something, and we did it. And Moses managed all the work. After all, it was to he on Mount Sinai that God gave the original plans and the original blueprints, if you want to say that. And so Moses had an eye, he had a vision, he had a construction over all of it, like an architect who sort of supervised the details of everything coming together. Now coming to Exodus chapter 40, all those individual pieces that were made in chapter 36, in chapter 37, in chapter 38, in chapter 39, all those individual pieces are now put together as a tabernacle in Exodus chapter 40. So they talk about how the furniture is arranged and how they're arranged in the courtyard, and then of the ceremony to consecrate the priests, and then the assembly of the tent with its curtains and all the rest of it. It's all getting put together in the first 19 verses of Exodus chapter 40, and then each piece of the tabernacle is described in its setting. Look at it here, starting at verse 20 of Exodus chapter 40. Read along with me here. It says this. He took the testimony and put it into the ark, inserted the poles through the rings of the ark, and put the mercy seat on top of the ark. And he brought the ark into the tabernacle, hung up the veil of the covering, and partitioned off the ark of the testimony, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, verse 22, the table of showbread. He put the table in the tabernacle of meeting on the north side of the tabernacle, outside the veil. And he set the bread in order upon it before the Lord, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Verse 24, the lampstand. Then he put the lampstand in the tabernacle of meeting across from the table on the south side of the tabernacle. And he lit the lamps before the Lord as the Lord had commanded Moses. Verse 26, the golden altar of incense. He put the gold altar in the tabernacle of meeting in front of the veil. He burned sweet incense on it as the Lord had commanded Moses. Verse 28, they hang up the screen. He hung up the screen at the door of the tabernacle. Verse 29, the brazen altar is put in place. And he put the altar of burnt offering before the door of the tabernacle of meeting and offered upon it the burnt offering and the grain offering as the Lord had commanded Moses. And then finally, verse 30 describes the laver for washing, you know, what they used all the mirrors for. Then he set the laver between the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, and he put water there for washing, and Moses and Aaron and his sons would wash their hands and their feet with water from it. Whenever they went into the tabernacle of meeting and whenever they came near the altar, they washed, as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now, friends, did you notice the repetition of a phrase in all of that? You did, didn't you? What's the phrase you noticed? As the Lord had commanded Moses. Matter of fact, that phrase or something very similar to it occurs not only multiple times in this chapter, but in the five chapters that we're considering all the way back to chapter 36, it occurs some 19 times over and over again. And there's a very deliberate stress here. The stress is this: God commanded them to do it, and they did it. And this brings us to a very important point, that as I speak it to you this morning, I understand just how out of step it is with the spirit of our age. It speaks to us about the importance of obedience. God says to do it, and we do it. That doesn't sound terribly complicated. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's not terribly complicated. But I wonder how you would be received. How about this? How would you be received if you were just to say this, or carry a sign, or wear a t-shirt with this message? It is important to obey God. Now, how would that be received? Yes! Man, I'm glad. There should be more people saying that. Or would people think, you religious freak, please put some distance between yourself and myself? I want you to think about that statement. It is important to obey God. Isn't it strange that we live in a culture today where that statement would be controversial in the ears of many or most people? If you think about it rationally, is it not important to obey God? It is important to obey Him. That is, if it's real. If it's real, it's important to obey Him. Listen, all I can tell you is that I believe with all of my life and with all of my heart that the message of this book, the message of Jesus Christ, who He is and what He did among us and everything that He taught and everything He validates, says to us that it is important to obey God. Now, I'll be honest with you. There's something within me. I'm not going to claim that it's within you. I won't presume to say that. But I will gladly admit to you that it's within me. There's something within me that doesn't want to obey God. There's something within me that says, don't you tell me what to do. I'll figure my own way. I'll follow my own heart. I'll figure it out myself. I know that that thing dwells within me. Maybe it dwells within you. But I know it's in me. And even though I understand that there's something in me that says, no, I don't need to obey God, I'll find my own way. Nevertheless, when I think about it rationally, not emotionally, rationally, I realize that if there really is a God in heaven, and if Jesus Christ really is His only Son, and if the life and the message and everything about Jesus is true, then it is absolutely essential that I obey God. And I know that I can't obey Him perfectly. I have not, I cannot, and neither can you. Yet nevertheless, God helping us, we must be serious about a life of obedience before Him. How painful it is that even though this message is lost in the culture at large, how tragic it is that it's lost so many times in the church. I don't think of myself in the slightest sense as a legalistic person. I love the grace of God. I feast on the grace of God. God's grace and mercy are my life. But ladies and gentlemen, obeying God isn't legalism. Obeying God is obedience. There's a very powerful phrase that's used once in the Psalms and once, I believe it's in 2 Chronicles. It's a phrase, the beauty of holiness. Now, if you think obedience is a strange word in our culture, just start using that word holiness. That'll really get you, boy, that if you think that word obedience gets you pushed outside the culture, just start using that other word. But friends, can I tell you, there is a beauty to obedience. There is a beauty to holiness. Can I give you an example? Think about the life that Jesus described by the Sermon on the Mount. Isn't that a beautiful life? The problem with the Sermon on the Mount isn't what he says. It's that we don't live up to it. And so I'm just expressing this to say that there's something powerful, something precious in us, this repetition of this phrase, as the Lord commanded Moses. That's what he did. And it brings me up short. And it says, Lord, I want to obey you better. I want to obey you more. I want holiness and obedience to be more beautiful to me than they are. Well, in verse 33 of chapter 40, they set up the outer court. It says, he raised up the outer court all around the tabernacle and the altar and hung up the screen of the court gate. So Moses finished the work. When that tabernacle was finally assembled, what you had was an earthly model of a heavenly reality. I know it might sound very strange to you, but that's what the Bible exactly says. That there is a reality of something in heaven where God dwells, and there's some correspondence between what Moses built and what exists actually in heaven. I don't know if it's a scale model. I don't know if it's a proportional thing. I don't know what it is exactly, but there's some kind of correspondence between what God commanded Moses to make and what actually exists in heaven. And so it doesn't surprise us that later on in the book of Revelation, there's a mention of the Ark of the Covenant. Later on in the book of Revelation, there's a mention of an altar of incense. Later on in the book of Revelation, in Isaiah, there's a mention of a structure that reminds us of the tabernacle. And in Hebrews chapter 9, little preview for our coming study in Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 9, it tells us that at some point after Jesus finished his essential and majestic work on the cross, at some point, Jesus entered into the heavenly reality that's represented on earth by the tabernacle that Moses built, and Jesus appeared in the presence of God to offer a perfect atonement for our sins. Therefore, every time that the high priest went into the Holy of Holies and put the blood of atonement upon the Ark of the Covenant, it was sort of a play acting, a foreshadowing. It was the trailer before the movie. It was all that established beforehand of what Jesus would eventually do when he went into the heavens, into the very courtroom of God, and offered his own atoning blood to cover your sins and my sins. I guess we're back to that matter of obedience. Because if you put up that word obedience over my life, I'll tell you what you could say, fail. It's just a fail. Nevertheless, what Jesus did on the cross pays the penalty for my failure and your failure.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. There's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.